Food is on the mind as we prepare for Thanksgiving. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Let's stop and think about one of the most important items that goes in so many recipes, flour. Sadly, a lot of the flour that we buy is processed, and it limits us in how we bake. We're going to talk with a former Miamian who is now a miller and is going to make you think differently about flour. Plus, we'll discuss some baking recipes. Also,
I have more of my Puerto Rican, my Cuban, my Dominican. Oh, forget about the Dominicans. I need to have picklies, picklies with eggs, picklies with this, picklies with spaghetti, picklies with everything.
Thanksgiving traditions are not the same in South Florida because of our eclectic population. We'll take a trip back through the years of food reporting at WLRN, from black cake to beaklies to manischewitz. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. You know, there's one thing that can't be absent at the Thanksgiving dinner table, and that's bread, whether it's bread rolls or cornbread. It's one of the oldest foods in human history. It's started revolutions. It's been an instrument of peace and even kept some of us sane during the pandemic. Remember the craze over bread baking? Well, there's more to bread than meets the eye. Joining us to help us understand some of that is Brian Wright. He's one of the owner-operators and the head bread baker at the Cafe Paradise Books and Bread in North Miami. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Also joining us is Jennifer Lapidus. She is a baker, miller, and author of the book Southern Ground, Reclaiming Flavor Through Stone-Milled Flour. Jennifer, great to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
You know, Jennifer, I wanted to start with you. I was thinking about this. I mean, bread's been around a long, long, long time. And of course, behind bread is flour. And so let's start with the big picture. How important is flour in our lives? And how do you think people take it for granted?
Right. You know, the pandemic really showed us, I think, in a huge way, when it's not on the shelf, people realize how important it is. But flour is the foundation of bread and pies and cookies and lots of things we really, really enjoy. But also, you know, it's a staple. It's a staple that having a meal without our staples, it's like, I think that was part of that craze when there wasn't flour on the shelf is we're missing staples. You know, I mean, if there wasn't apples on the shelf, I don't think there would have been as much of an emotional reaction as not having flour on the shelf.
Yeah. We learned a couple of things that need to be on the shelf or we tend to lose it a little bit. Brian,
toilet paper,
flour and toilet paper. Exactly. Yeah. Brian, how should we be thinking about flour? I mean, I know you're a baker, but, you know, what do you think about the rest of us? How should we be thinking about flour and its importance in our lives?
I mean, I think it just deserves more attention than it usually gets. I think, you know, the type of flour that Jennifer puts out, you know, stone ground flour, it should be treated more as like a fresh product rather than something that sits on the shelf for years and, you know, it still stays the same. This is something that, you know, has oils in it that capture the specific place it comes from, and depending on the freshness and where it's from, it totally changes the flavor and the product that you end up with.
So you're the head baker, bread baker at Paradise. Did baking always come easy to you?
I mean, I have a weird entry point into it. I don't have any formal training in baking. I just sort of got into it my last year in college, like around 2014, and since that point, me and my partner, we just sort of like, it was always just bread, and we like into starter that whole time and have always been baking every week since then. And this is the first time we've ever like scaled up to a professional sort of production level. And so it's been fun, difficult, you know, so it definitely hasn't come easy, I would say.
I was just thinking to myself, wait a second, the last year of college and you start getting into baking. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What was I doing my last year of college? Oh yeah. I spent it on a surfboard and chasing girls. What in the world, what were you doing? How did the baking start in your life?
I mean, I think It was at a time where like fermentation was really popular. I don't know. Like, I was in school in New York, and so fermentation started working its way into all the cool restaurants at the time. And so you just wanted to try it out for yourself, like either making sauerkraut or making some mead with, you know, honey in a mason jar or something. So bread and sourdough is another aspect of this, like, sort of thing that was capturing everyone's interest at the time.
Everybody takes a different path, that's for sure. Jennifer, yeah. Your relationship, you know, with flour actually started with baking. Did baking come easy to you?
Right. Well, you know, I was a baker from, I had a commercial bakery from 1994 to 2008. And I grew up in South Miami when the Wholesome Bread Factory was in downtown South Miami. I don't know if you were around for that period, but, you know, the smell of fresh baked bread was always existed in South Miami at that, in the, you know, late 1970s, I guess. I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And so I tend to think that little memory did percolate for me, because it was also my last year of college that I got interested in bread baking. And I was a history major in college. And as you alluded to earlier about how old bread is, I was very intrigued by the Industrial Revolution, that time in history, and what was lost and what was gained at that crossroads, and the reaction from the writers and the artists to, like, the mechanization of things. And so when I started baking, I sort of had this gut sense of, you know, I was, as a history major, realizing, like, wow, this has been here a long time. This is a remnant of our past, but not fully. And I had a, back then it was just a yeasted bread, but I had a gut sense that it should be more than that. I mean, initially, whether it was with yeast or sourdough, baking your first few loaves, I mean, you know, you start out with plenty of bricks, but I just kept doing it, which is a big part of baking, is just keep doing it. And then I followed my sense and finally found information about sourdough, but this was in the 1990s. There was very little information out there. We called it natural leavening then. Now the term is ubiquitous, sourdough. But, you know, it was very fringe back then, and it's really exciting to see just how many bakers are engaging with just, I mean, natural leavening or sourdough. You're working with microbes that are either on your flour itself, so you want a flour that's very alive and fresh, or maybe airborne, like San Francisco sourdough or Alaskan style, or on grapes. I mean, there's, you're trying, kind of going for what's out there, I think that baking is forever this kind of path of, at least for me, of like always seeking that sort of perfect loaf, and it just intrinsic in the process of baking is continuing the process to, you know, little tweaks every time. And you know, I don't know if Michael, I mean, yeah, I don't know if Brian, you feel the same way, but that to me as a baker was always like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was thinking about something you just said too, which is just that you have to keep making it. Which I think that's my problem, is I have no patience, and I fail at baking, and I'm done. I'm out. I'll leave it to somebody else. You know, I wanted to know, because as I was going, Jennifer, as I was going through your book, the one thing that hit me, I mean, again, here you are now working on creating these different flours, and something that Brian said earlier, you know, it's compared to what you're doing compared to what's out there in the stores, which could sit there for a long time. It's made to sit there for a long time, but you know, you're coming at it from this different perspective. And I wondered, is that where we're going now? Is that, you know, we're entering some era, or maybe we're already in it, where people are thinking about changing the way they eat, buying more sustainable, looking for better quality, looking for something that may be more natural. I don't know, Brian, am I making that up, or am I thinking that's where we're heading?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like there's some momentum growing in that direction, both with, you know, like, especially in the Miami context, like natural wine is another really popular thing right now. So people are definitely getting more interested in these, like, farmer focused products that are fresh and aren't meant to just be sort of like always readily available and always, you know, never going bad. But it's hard to say, you know, what the longevity of that is in any given space, you know. but it, you know, I'm hopeful that that's where we're heading.
Yeah, Jennifer, I mean, you know, in I want to get to the topic of flour. In your book, you write about the community mill. Explain that concept and some of the, a little bit of the history behind it.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, and it sort of, again, goes back to that crossroads of the Industrial Revolution of what were the things that we lost and what were the things that we gained. And, you know, the flour you see on the grocery store shelf was produced in a very efficient manner, but and it's shelf stable, and yet it lacks flavor and it lacks nutrients that, well, it later had to be enriched to get those nutrients, but the way that it was processed enabled the product to be shipped and sat, you know, sort of vertical integration and centralization of one product that could then be distributed out on, you know, on the shelf. It's not going to go bad. Whereas what happens when you bring back the community mill is it's intrinsically a community effort. The miller can't exist without the bakers that are going to support it and the farmers that are going to feed that. And then all the other pieces, like from seed, for us, it's been working with public breeders to breed for our region. And this is not genetic modification. This is old school breeding. Wheat actually has not been commercially genetically modified, and old practices of breeding where they're all of the varieties have one foot in the Fertile Crescent, the original wheats. And so you start with the breeder, you have maybe a crop that doesn't take for the baker, but then you have the brewer or the maltster or the feed mill, or I mean, we have a pig farmer who comes and picks up our middlings, our waste product, and then he comes back to us with meat for our millers, you know. I mean, there's just so many, and then the bakers that have the story that they can share with their customers to understand where the grain came from,
right,
where the, you know, so there, it just becomes very much, you know, community and story
it
that
does.
Is lifting this product.
And I just saying, reading through the book, it made me think about that. We live in this global, you know, global world, and it's so much about mass production. And I thought, can we go back to a, I guess, what's simpler, but also more, I think, more natural way of doing things? Is that profitable enough? But something that it made me think about, so fascinating. Again, talking with Jennifer Lapidus about her book, Southern Ground, Reclaiming Flavor Through Stone Milled Flour. She's a baker, miller, and author. We're also talking with Brian White, one of the owner operators and the head bread baker at the Cafe Paradise Books and Bread in North Miami. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and let's talk some recipes as we get ready for Thanksgiving. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Let's keep that conversation going about bread and baking. If it's not making you hungry, I certainly am, because we're going to spend a lot of time in the kitchen this year, whether that's actually cooking, baking, or tasting, you know, because Thanksgiving is here and the holidays are upon us. Again, we're talking with Brian Wright. He is the head bread baker at the Cafe Paradise Books and Bread in North Miami. And Jennifer Lapidus, she is a baker, miller, and author. Her book is called Southern Ground, Reclaiming Flavor Through Stone Milled Flour. Going through this book, by the way, too, lots of amazing recipes, and love the pictures, made me so hungry. Jennifer, what is the key to, you know, getting it right? You said doing it many times, you get it right, but all right, for those of us who are not the expert, can you help me out here?
Okay, I think that starting out with just letting go of our intimidation of baking. You know, I think a lot of people are just, that baking can sort of seem like a very intimidating territory, you know, realm to step into. And I think that one of the nice things about having good ingredients means that even our quote unquote failures are going to taste pretty good, you know? I think that, you know, my attempt with the book, I gathered recipes from, I mean, it was, some of them were my own recipes and the others were drawn from bakers that we work with throughout the Southeast. And so the attempt with the recipes in the book was to give, you know, the home baker the tools to work with regional flours that may, you know, not be as, you know, they're certainly not homogenous. And so what one might expect of just sort of opening a bag of flour. So we wanted to, you know, open the door for the home baker. And if one looks at the book, you can see that the recipes, I mean, I'm going to say non-bread recipes because we're talking Thanksgiving. And so, you know, pies and cookies and crackers and that sort of thing, where I really was looking for flavor and flour to work. I mean, Brian was alluding that too, you know, having the flour be one of the ingredients that is right up there with the eggs and butter or spices, you know, with our, and really sort of tuning into the spice element of the flavor forward element of the flour that can align well with whatever the recipe is one is doing. Like if it's a more refined recipe, then we're using a more sifted flour. But so the recipes themselves are a good guide, but I think my biggest piece of advice to the home baker is to not be married to the recipe, to be okay with listening to your gut. If you feel like something just needs a little more of this or a little more of that, do it. Because we do that in cooking. And you know, it's people think, you know, with baking, you have to follow every little step. And I personally feel like we got to remember that we've got a sense, you know, I think everybody really does. If you just, you're stirring something, you're mixing something up, it's like pancakes. I'm like, throw a little more liquid in there if it needs it. And, you know, I've always done that with pancakes, and to say it's okay to do that with other recipes, you know? So, I mean, I think trying a recipe the first time and then making adjustments the next time is perfectly okay.
And
in fact, it's, yeah.
I mean, I hear you, but you haven't tried my stuff yet. That's the problem. you know, that it's easy to say. No, I know what you're saying. I think patience is not my virtue. Brian, what have you heard from customers? I find it interesting, by the way, you started, you guys opened up during the pandemic, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, thankfully vaccines were getting pretty widely distributed by the time we did open. We opened in like mid-July.
Okay.
You know, pandemic is definitely still ongoing, as we're all aware. So it's definitely an interesting time.
And what are you hearing from customers about what they're looking for in you know, qualities of bread? Because we've had bakers on the show before, and the one thing I find interesting is, yeah, there's we're getting a little more sophisticated, but we want, because we want what quality?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially customers in South Florida in general are just like constantly being inundated by whatever the newest trend is, and that's all that's available to us really for the most part, and whatever you know form that comes in or what sort of intention goes into producing that product. So I think our customers have just been most appreciative of the fact that we try and simplify everything, and you know, we let the ingredients speak for themselves. You know, it's not like we're not doing a really complicated pastry that, you know, is a really incredible skill that people have. It's just sort of like, you know, some good butter, some good flour, you know, sugar and chocolate, and put it all together. And it's a really humble ingredient that we serve. And so I think people appreciate that, just like affordable, well-made stuff, you know.
Absolutely. All right, let me finish with this. I want to ask both of you what you are most thankful for this Thanksgiving. Brian, let me start with you.
Yeah, I mean, to be open has been an amazing gift so far, and to be received in South Florida the way we have has been incredible. And my sister and I, who's also a business partner with me, we recently moved our mom closer to us, like down the street from the business. So we get to spend a lot more time with her, which has been amazing. So that's probably it.
That's a good thing to be thankful for. And Jennifer, what about you?
Yeah, I would say also family. Yeah, my sister has been amazing with cheering me on with this book and coming home to Miami. I'm with my mom right now, my husband, and it's just, it always feels like coming home when I'm down here. So I'm super thankful to be down here in Miami right now.
How often do you get back down to Miami? Cause you're up in North Carolina.
Right. Yeah. In normal world, we usually are here at least once a year. But you know, with the pandemic, it's been less.
Well, I really appreciate the time and the opportunity to talk with both of you. You gave me a little more confidence but it's going to be tough for me, but I'm going to give it a shot. But if not, you know what? I can always just go to Brian. I'm going to let the expert make the bread for me. Brian Wright, again, he's the owner, one of the owner operators and head bread baker at the Cafe Paradise Books and Bread in North Miami. Jennifer Lapidus is the baker, miller, and author of the book Southern Ground, Reclaiming Flavor Through Stone Milled Flour. She's going to be speaking at Books and Books in Coral Gables Friday evening. We have more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jennifer, Brian, thank you so much. Jennifer, enjoy your stay while you're down here.
Thank you. Thank you so
Thanks
much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And again, you can find more information about the event and about the book on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Still to come, we're thinking about one thing for the rest of the week, and that's food. And we're going to bring you some of WLRN's best food stories from over the years. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We know food is on the brain today. That's why we wanted to reshare some of WLRN's best stories over the years on how food brings South Floridians together. Last year, because of COVID, some of our food celebrations looked a little different during the holidays. WLRN reporter Danny Rivero and our intern at the time, Natu Tway, decided to have some fun doing a family recipe swap. Danny shared his family recipe for Cuban congri, and Natu shared a Liberian version of the West African specialty, jollof rice.
So the recipe I'm sharing with you is the recipe for Cuban congri. And it's a dish that's, you know, it's almost staple food here in South Florida. It's really simple. It's a one-pot dish of black beans and white rice cooked together. And you usually take little bits of meat like bacon or just a pork chunk or a little bits of chorizo, and you put it all into the pot and you cook it all together with the rice and the beans. And, you know, a lot of families have their versions of it. My family has our version of it. My mom's side of the family came from Eastern Cuba, where this is from. And I actually recently really asked my grandma, Abuela Nena, we call her, and I asked her to give me her recipe for it. She's been making this for decades. I've been eating it for decades.
El caldo prieto, y se cocinan los frijoles con el caldo prieto. Y cuando el arroz está a mitad, se le echa.
And I really wanted that recipe, even if I could go around the corner almost anywhere in South Florida and get a pretty good pot of it, right?
Same with my grandmother now. It's been, I think this is my first Christmas without her in a while because she moved back to Liberia, and I would always make something with her, or I'd watch her make something. We'd do it together, whether it's like jollof rice or any other Liberian dish, palm butter, cassava leaf, or if we were just doing something simple. And being able to share my recipe with someone else really kind of made me feel like I was still doing that with her, even if she wasn't here, in a different capacity, you know. Jollof rice is a versatile, practically one-pot dish. It comes from West Africa. It originates from Senegal, from the Wolof people, the Jollof Empire, way back in the day. It made its way throughout West Africa. Nigerians, Ghanaians, Liberians all have their take on jollof rice. And the essence of it is essentially rice in this tomato sauce, this tomato coloring. And you can generally add what you want. Liberians add a lot of meats to jollof rice. It'll be rice with mixed vegetables. My mom likes to add mushrooms, you know, onions, bell pepper, and then like chicken, beef, pork, shrimp, all those added together create jollof rice.
So we seasoned it with some maggi and salt, pepper, oil, onion, and garlic powder. We're gonna make the sauce. You ready? We're gonna make the sauce. One, two, three. One thing I did is I played Celia Cruz while I was cooking because it seemed very appropriate, you know, because she celebrates her West African heritage. And I'm Cuban, I celebrate her heritage, and there's a pretty straight line. Okay, now this is looking like a meal that I want to eat. I got the chicken and the veggies and the red rice. Mmm! Natu, this is fire.
Even though I had followed every step possible in the recipe, I made the rookie mistake of taking my black beans off the water too early. By the time I had already mix the sofrito and the rice and the black beans and the water, they were still hard after they came out 45 minutes later. And I could either leave it as is, take out every individual black bean, or add more water to the pot in an attempt to soften the beans up, which is what I did. So in the end, I pretty much came out with congri porridge. I may have messed up when cooking the beans, but I'm not a bean rookie. It's not my first time making a dish with beans. And it may be my first time making congri, but I'm not a stranger to the dish either. I've had it many times here in South Florida. I know what it's supposed to taste like. That's probably the best congri I've had in a very, very long time. It was so good. You just can't go wrong with a simple dish that is still so delicious, even when you mess it up.
And that was WLRN reporter Danny Rivera with one of our former interns, Natu Twe. Now from rice, we go to condiments. Piklis is a spicy Haitian variety that you could put on almost anything. Former WLRN reporter Nadej Green went on a mission in 2019 to find out how it's gotten so popular through South Florida's food scene, Haitian or not.
Piklis is a spicy Haitian condiment. It's ubiquitous in Haitian restaurants and homes here in South Florida. You can find it in a glass jar or a plastic bowl. Piklis has also become really popular among people in the know outside the Haitian community. Cynthia Verna is a Haitian chef. Everyone calls her Chef Tia. And she says her friends are always asking her to make piklis for them.
I have more of my Puerto Rican, my Cuban, my Dominican. Oh, forget about the Dominicans. I need to have piklis, piklis with eggs, piklis with this, piklis with spaghetti, piklis with everything.
Some people describe piklis as a spicy vinegar coleslaw or a Haitian spicy kimchi. The condiment comes with most savory Haitian dishes. Chef Tia is preparing a small batch. First, she chops up some cabbage. She uses a grater to shred some carrots and then the heart of the piklis, the Scotch bonnet pepper. Chef Tia cuts the pepper finely and sprinkles salt on it before mixing it all together in a bowl.
Spicier, like fiery. We want the seed in there, okay? We want to chop the seed, so I'm going to go.
Chef Tia grew up in Pétionville, Haiti, and she says she started making piklis when she was about 7 or 8.
Oh, we would learn mostly when we used to go in Provence with my grandparents in Tigouave, and that's where I learned with the people.
The people were the Haitian women street vendors who cooked fuitai, fried pork, fried plantain, fried shredded yuca, and giant pots of hot oil on the side of the road. And fuitai always gets topped with a generous helping of piklis. Chef Tia squeezes some lime into the bowl with her cabbage, carrots, and pepper, a little vinegar, and that's it.
And what is the best way to keep anything for long? It's an acid. So simple, salt, acid, lime or vinegar. Those are cheap things.
She says piklis is the perfect condiment. It doesn't need any refrigeration, and it actually gets better with time. And it's easy to get, too. Locally, some grocery stores like Publix, Winn-Dixie, and Walmart carry it. There are artisanal piklis makers at farmers markets, and Haitian piklis is making its way onto non-Haitian restaurant menus.
And then we have our open patio in the back.
The Head or Tails seafood market is sandwiched between Hialeah and Liberty City, and it's been serving piklis for 10 years.
I'm Cuban, and we eat a lot of Cuban food, and we eat tostones, which are the green platanos. I know Haitians eat a lot of that, too, and we love putting it, too, on the tostones.
Willie Perez owns Head or Tails.
And people here love to put it on fish, on rice, on everything.
He says he was introduced to piklis when he used to work at Zuby Supermarket, a grocery store that caters to mostly Haitians in Little Haiti. A Haitian woman named Chris would bring jars of piklis to sell there, and he started buying them from her to serve at his restaurant. He says many of his customers had never heard of piklis, but now?
We've run out of piklis, and people, no piklis, okay, I don't want food then.
Perez estimates he goes through about 10 gallons of piklis a week. In Little Haiti in Miami, there's a Chinese restaurant that serves fried rice and egg rolls with a side of piklis. A few blocks down, Claude Postel is the owner and chef at 6010, an organic rotisserie chicken restaurant. He's from France.
This beautiful paper there, you know, it's just wonderful, you know.
This isn't too surprising. A lot of Haitians work in the restaurant industry here.
We have Haitian cook who's working with me for a long time, you know, and he teach me how to make it.
Haitian entrepreneurs are also capitalizing on the popularity of picles by making the spicy condiment and selling it in glass jars. Georges Ebelaguer runs a small cafe in Little Haiti. He goes by T-Georges. T-Georges says, depending on where you're from in Haiti, every picles has its own special touch.
You go to the northern part, you find another style. Then you come to the central part of Haiti, you find another style.
The base is always cabbage and carrots.
I recall observing my grandmother making her own style of picles. She will get the green beans, mince them out, and she will put shallots in it and also sour oranges.
And when people ask T-Georges, what do you put picles on?
I'm going to say on everything.
Picles on everything.
That was former WLRN reporter Nadej Green. Now, staying in the Caribbean, back in 2018, WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett shared his specialty for the holidays. It's a treat called black cake. Every time Paran
season comes along. You call it Parang in. It's tradition from its time.
It's Parang season at Sweet Hand Kathy, a Trinidadian bakery and restaurant in Miami Gardens, which means it's Christmas season. Kathy Ann Paul, she's Sweet Hand Kathy's owner, was raised in the Caribbean island country of Trinidad and Tobago. And when December rolls around, she fills the place with Trinidadian parang songs.
Very important. Christmas Eve night, we have a big event here. We have DJ playing outside in the parking lot.
But right now, Paul is inside her bakery kitchen making something else that's very important to a Trinidadian Christmas. Actually, more important. The heavenly rum-soaked fruit confection called black cake. It is arguably the most important food fixture of any Caribbean Christmas celebration.
January, everybody starts soaking the fruits.
You heard her. It's so important that folks start preparing the black cake a year before Christmas.
There's so many different fruits, like tutti frutti, which is made out of orange peels and citrus fruits. We have the cherry, they put the walnuts, the currants, raisins, and then you have the prunes. You have to soak it with wine and you have to soak it with rum.
Especially rum. Did I mention for a whole year? But black cake is more than just rum cake, and it's more than the fruit cake Americans know. In fact, Paul's disappointment after tasting American fruit cake here helped convince her to start a bakery and to make a lot of black cakes at Christmas.
My grandmother inspired me to do black cake, right? And my grandmother would bake, and then everybody in the village always get a cake. So that's the reason why I am so used of cooking in large amount.
And in her own style. To turn that marinated fruit mixture into the dark, caramelized delight known as black cake, she uses her grandmother's ingredients.
Cinnamon, nutmeg, vanilla, rose water, cola essence.
But also her own secret ingredients, including
granulated bay leaf. When I use it, it was a hit. Give it my own twist. I wish my grandmother was alive today to really taste my cake, and she would have been really, really, really proud.
Not just Trinidadians, but the entire Caribbean take pride in black cake, or at least the English-speaking islands. And that's the point. The islanders consider their Christmas black cake an exquisite refinement of the Christmas plum pudding their former British colonial overlords introduced to the West Indies. And every island's recipe, from Barbados to the Bahamas, Grenada to Guyana, is a little different. And that's created some fun intra-Caribbean rivalry.
But I know everybody who makes it from any country, they will say that their cake is the best.
When Maurice Chang lost his job in Miami during the last recession, he decided to reconnect with his home island, Jamaica. Chang and his Jamaican wife, Marcia, opened Jamrock, a popular Jamaican eatery in Kendall. Each December, he bakes his family's black cake recipe, created in Colleyville, Jamaica.
It does have a lot of meaning to me. We tried to be perfect with it.
Perfect, Chang says, because he feels it's a key part of preserving Jamaican and Caribbean culture here in South Florida, a culture he fears may be waning.
We are getting a little bit more Americanized, and although we are not losing our identity, our culture, we are sort of in a survival mode.
That renewed urgency to promote black cake has another interesting benefit. Bakers in South Florida's various Caribbean communities are borrowing from each other's recipes. Don't tell the Trinidadian Rum Makers Association, but the Trinidadian Kathy Ann Paul now uses Jamaican overproof rum to soak her black cake.
I like it for my black cake. More citrus smell.
So I brought Paul's Trinidadian black cake and Chang's Jamaican black cake back to the WLRN studios for our staff to try.
Oh, wow. Mmm.
It's just a happy medley of goodness.
Oh, that's so good.
And the winner is? Well, you don't think we're really that foolish, do you? They were both superb.
Mm. Thank you.
You just heard from WLRN America's correspondent Tim Padgett. He's got a list of bakeries in South Florida that make black cake on our website at WLRN.org. And that also goes for all of these classic WLRN food stories that we're sharing with you today. We're also linking them on our social media at WLRN Sundial. This next one has special meaning for our multimedia producer, Alyssa Ramos. When your loved one lives thousands of miles away, sometimes a familiar dish can close the distance. Here's one dish that brings Alyssa feeling closer to her grandmother.
I knew it was a special occasion when I saw the pastel green and yellow bundt pans crowding the kitchen counters. But cake wasn't on the menu. We were making cathedral window, or as we like to call it, broken window.
You remember you had to choose? There's so many different colors in the glass.
This is my grandma, my mom's mom. Luvisminda Kapunan. Like she says, the different colors resemble the stained glass windows you see in a church. Colorful cubes of jello are suspended in another gelatin. The recipe calls for different flavors: cherry, lemon, lime, strawberry. Just imagine a cake made completely out of jello.
You don't make that every day or any other day. It's only in those times.
It wasn't any other day. It was Christmas. It was also my great-grandmother's 90th birthday. I was 8 years old, and it was my first time visiting the Philippines. Both sides of my family are from the same small town, and everyone was there. As a kid, I was too picky to try broken window, but I never forgot about it, so I wanted to make it myself. My grandma, who lives in Florida, tells me she learned how to make it from the true master of the broken window. My other grandma.
Your grandma Ine made it, and I got it from her. Because when she was doing it, I was watching her.
My grandmothers have been friends for most of their lives. And then their kids, my parents, married each other. My dad's mom, I call her Lola Ine, still lives in the Philippines. She's in her 80s, and she's not so great with technology. So it's hard for us to connect. I asked my dad for help instead. His name is Pompey Ramos.
It's so special because not too many can do it good, like my mom. And she perfected it because, you know, if you cannot do it well, it will come out watery, mushy, because the finished product should be like firm. It's like you're slicing a cake.
My Lola says the recipe's simple. It just takes a lot of time. But that's not what I found when I tried to make it. First step. Cook no more than 5 different flavors of jello, each in their own dish. Once they are firm enough, I'm going to check the yellow, so the lemon flavored jello. Poking it right now. It's jiggly. Cut them into cubes and place them in the molder. That's the one shaped like a bundt pan. Then you make unflavored Knox gelatin and mix it together with Carnation condensed milk and Nestle cream. Both of my grandmothers swear by these brands. Ahead of special occasions, we even have to ship the gelatin packets to Banga. That's where my Lola lives. I know what you must be thinking. It's just jello. That's what I thought too. But why does it smell like it's burning? I have a really bad feeling. About this. I thought I could cut some corners. I didn't have any measuring tools, so I just eyeballed it. Oh god, it's sticking to the bottom. Okay,
Enough. I can't believe I'm burning gelatin right now.
If you haven't burned your gelatin, at this point in the process, you're ready to pour the creamy mixture into the mold so that the cubes are submerged. Once it sets, out pops a wreath of colorful gelatin.
The gelatin tastes like flan.
My dad says when it's made the right way,
it's not overpowering sweetness to it.
My dad and my mom have been here in the States for decades now. They raised me in Ocala. As a result, they left some of our family traditions behind in the Philippines. Making Broken Window is really about reviving those traditions and connecting with my grandmother.
I think she feels satisfied every time she makes this because people likes to eat it. And if she's not around, then you're gonna sure miss it.
I might never make it like my Lola does, but I'm going to try again. This time the right way, with my family on Christmas.
That was WLRN's multimedia producer, Alyssa Ramos. Her grandmother sadly passed away earlier this year due to COVID-19. And although her grandmother is gone, she keeps her memory alive with a platter of Jell-O. You've heard about Christmas time sweets and traditions. Now it's time to hear about a not always beloved Jewish tradition that is very beloved in Haiti, Manischewitz kosher wine. Former WLRN reporter Nadege Green went looking for the Caribbean connection behind Manischewitz back in 2017.
I was scrolling through Instagram when I saw a billboard in Haiti advertising Manischewitz wine. The kosher wine has been a constant in Jewish homes for Passover Seder and other occasions. And in Jewish circles, it's nostalgic, but not exactly considered a fine wine.
Gaggy.
Among some people from the Caribbean, though, it's beloved. The Instagram photo was posted by Miami journalist Glenna Milberg. She was in Haiti covering the presidential election for WPLG Channel 10.
And right in front of me is this Manischewitz poster. I said, stop, I gotta get out. And I think the caption I put under it was something like, a kosher Creole connection. Who knew? Which is kind of a Jewish way to say things anyway. Who knew?
Milberg grew up with Manischewitz wine, but she didn't actually enjoy it.
Horrible. It's sweet. It's syrupy. It's gaggy. And so no one ever wanted to drink the Manischewitz because it tasted like cough syrup. Please, no disrespect to Manischewitz.
I also grew up with Manischewitz wine, and I'm not Jewish. It's just that my Haitian mom really liked it. So when Milberg asked,
who knew?
I did, and so did Hazel Bethel. She says for her,
Manischewitz is put in most everything.
Bethel is originally from Trinidad, and she lives in South Miami-Dade. She drizzles Manischewitz over ice cream.
Get some cherry ice cream and some Manischewitz. It's the bomb.
She might spike her morning drink with it.
Mix your coffee.
She adds it to her traditional holiday fruitcake called black cake.
So I have some black cake soaking right now with some Manischewitz.
And if she's just in the mood for a glass of wine.
Manischewitz, of course. Manischewitz.
When Bethel moved to the U.S. from Trinidad, she first settled in New York, where other Trinidadian expats introduced her to Manischewitz wine. Many of her friends worked as housekeepers or caretakers in Jewish homes.
Do you see it there? So the next thing you know, you go and buy it, and it's cheap.
It probably became popular in the Caribbean by way of the diaspora in the United States. Last year, the Wall Street Journal ran a story about its popularity in Asian American communities. And in the 1950s and 60s, it was also a popular wine in the African American community.
Sammy Davis Jr., who converted to Judaism at some point, endorsed Manischewitz.
Jay Buxbaum is director of wine education at Royal Wine Corporation, one of the top kosher wine importers. The company is not affiliated with Manischewitz. He says when Jews first arrived to New York, they needed wine for most religious ceremonies and holidays.
The only grapes that were available were something called the Concord. Those grapes, unlike European grapes, are actually quite sour. They're not sweet. So in order to make them palatable, they would make this very sour grape into wine, and then they would add sugar.
Hazel Bethel is pouring a glass of sorrel over ice. In Trinidad, she says, it's not Christmas without the fragrant drink made from hibiscus blooms.
Some people put white rum. I choose Manischewitz because Manischewitz gives it just the right flavor.
Her daughter, Carla Hill, jokes about the time her mom had a girl's night in.
Child, they were pulling out the Manischewitz and glasses, and I was like, oh my gosh, they're about to get lit up in here on some Manischewitz.
My kids feel that I should be drinking something more high class, but this is just good enough class for me.
Her love for the very sweet Manischewitz reminds her daughter of a Pahrang soca song they like to play around the holidays. The name of the song is I Want Some Homemade Wine, Gloria.
Maybe when my mom came here in the 70s and she had this Manischewitz, maybe it reminded her she was so far away from these homemade wines. Maybe it sparked something.
Probably did. My grandmother, she liked something called Caribton, her drink of the holidays. It was a light, it was white, but it was a Manischewitz.
Hazel Bethel will enjoy a glass of Manischewitz wine on Christmas Day.
And we saved one of the best for last, an oldie. In 2013, former WLRN reporter Rick Stone waited in line for Knosberry Farm's famous Amish cinnamon buns. Brave men waited for hours. So did South Floridians from all over.
The Knaus brothers founded Knosberry Farm in the 1950s on 80 acres where they would grow strawberries, tomatoes, and squash. At some point, they added a little bakery off to the side. Their descendants run the place now, the women in blue jeans, the men in beards that honor the family's German Baptist faith. The farm does fine, but the bakery is why people line up for hours every morning during the holiday season.
I don't know, they just come. We bake and they come.
What they bake are cinnamon buns from an old Knaus family recipe, says manager and Knaus descendant Rachel Graff. They are said to be extremely good cinnamon buns. Boosted by social media and rapturous Yelp reviews, they've gone viral over the years. During the holidays, South Floridians demand them.
We've been standing in line two hours.
It feels like 2 years.
Terry Munoz and selected family members are back in the cinnamon bun line for their third or fourth Christmas Eve.
I have part of my family here. The rest is working. Now I go home and I have to start cooking.
But you regret not a minute of this?
No, we don't. It'll be worth every minute that I spent here.
The line is long, the sun is hot, but it's Christmas. People are socializing and reconnecting since the last time they stood in the cinnamon bun line together.
We got here at about 9:15. What time is it?
10:39.
The testy guy with the watch is Glenn Murphy, who drove down from Broward County with Terry McIntyre for his first taste of Knosberry Farm cinnamon buns. He's having a great time pretending to be annoyed.
An hour in the car, an hour in line to get a cinnamon bun that I could go 20 feet from my house and get from Panera.
Bystanders tell Glenn knowingly they expect to see him in the line again next year. If you'd like to see what the fuss is all about, drive south on Dixie Highway to 248th Street, go right, drive 113 more blocks, and bring cash. Like a lot of addictive things, you can't buy the cinnamon buns with a credit card.
Knosberry Farms is still open in Homestead, and they're in season. Make sure you share your Knosberry Farm line stories with us on our social media at WLRN Sundial. How long are you waiting in line to get those buns for Thanksgiving? Well, that's all the food stories that we have time for today, but there's loads more, again, on our website, WLRN.org, or find them through our social media at WLRN Sundial. And I want to get in line right now for some of those buns. Who is with me? Let's go. I want to thank everyone, you know, who put all those stories together, because a lot of those folks aren't with us anymore, but some of the best reporters I ever had the chance to work with. A lot of beautiful stories and a lot of fun. Well, that's our program for this Wednesday, November 24th. Obviously, no show tomorrow. It's Thanksgiving. So I hope that you and your family are having a wonderful time, and that you get to spend time together around the table and enjoy a beautiful meal and just enjoy the day and rest. Coming up next week on the program, Miami Art Week 2021. It's upon us. So is Art Basel. We're going to talk to some artists involved in shows, others that are working on some cool projects that you probably won't see in the big tents. We're going to talk about the state of art in Miami, plus big state gambling news and Florida Atlantic University is changing its sports conferences. We'll tell you all about that and more coming up next week. Just want to mention, because I've been asking a lot of guests, what are they grateful for this Thanksgiving holiday? So what am I grateful for? What are you grateful for? Well, I'm grateful for the fact that my parents who live in Columbia are back in the States for the holidays to spend time with me and my brother and the niece and the nephews and a lot of the family coming together. Always great to have that. Great to be here hosting this program, working with two awesome kick-butt producers, Katie and Leslie. Thank you so much. They make me look really good. Let's just say that. Also great to be here at WLRN. Love the crew, everyone here. It's such a fun place to work at. And again, all the stories that you heard. I mean, that's what we get to do every day. So thank you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in every single day and letting us know what you think of the program. As always, stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.